Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. If you head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, you'll find some photos of today's guest, 92-year-old Max DeSaint-Jour of Orem, Utah. You'll also find photos and information relating to the Freckleton Air disaster and the tragedy that unfolded on August 23, 1944. There was a violent storm blowing in on Base Air Depot 2 in Wharton, England. Winds reported as strong as 60 miles an hour, water spouts in a nearby estuary, flash flooding all around. If you were to go to Wharton today, you would find a memorial to the 61 people who perished that day, three aboard a malfunctioning B-24, 58 more on the ground. It's a reminder that everywhere is dangerous during wartime. This came at a time that the Allies were advancing across Europe after the landing at Normandy. England would seem like a safer place, but not on August 23rd, 1944, in Wharton. Max, what do you remember about that day?
It was about lunchtime, and it got just almost dark, black clouds and that. And we had a B-24 come in to crash. It went right through a cafe, Sad Sack Cafe, they call it. It went through the and landed in the town square right next to a elementary school. It killed, I think, 36 of those little kids. They just had a mass funeral and burial for all those kids. And they had GIs carrying the caskets on their shoulder, two GIs to a casket. And this one good friend of mine, the name of Tom Miller, he was carrying this little girl. And after the war, when he come home, got married, and he had a daughter, and he named her after this little girl that he had carried. And when we went back there for a reunion in 1995, his daughter got to go back with him, and she got to meet the mother of the little girl. That it was kind of a tear-jerking situation, you know, really a sad situation. But
yeah, I can only imagine. And then I imagine, too, just trying to put myself in your shoes. Here you're over there, you're a 20-year-old kid from Provo, Utah, and you're half a world away from your family. Your brothers are off in this war, too. And everything you read, everything you hear on the radio, and then this that you see right in front of your eyes at your base, it's just tragedy all the time. How did you process that? How did you make sense of that?
Well, it was just something you got, I guess you just say you got used to, you know. But that was quite a experience, you know, have all that happened there at the base.
While you were over there also, did you get a sense of how devastating the damage that England had endured was with bombings and buzz bombs and all of that?
Oh, yeah. You go to London, it's just blow your mind how much damage there was and destruction, you know. It was terrible. Those English people, I always admired them because they really stuck together. And
from all the veterans I've talked to, you all tell me that America stuck together during this time too, that everybody was on the same page. And for you personally, did you have a clear understanding of why you were doing what you were doing and what the whole purpose of it was?
Oh, yeah. I think it was just something that you knew had to be done. You know, you didn't like it maybe, but you knew that it had to be done.
And you mentioned how rough it was when you first got over there, how many planes were being shot down and how big the losses were. As time went on, could you sense a shift, even being there on the ground in England? But because of the work you were doing with all these planes, did you notice a difference? And could you tell that the tide was turning?
Oh, yes, you could tell because you had more planes coming back. You wouldn't have near the casualties you were when they first started. It was a tide that just got a little better all the time, you know, until the end.
And I want to hear about what you remember about the end, but I'm also curious, since you were one of four brothers all serving in this war at the same time, I don't know what your mother did with all her time other than pray nonstop if she's got four sons out there in this war. What, if anything, did you hear from your brothers? Were you in touch with them?
Oh, yeah. We had letters back and forth all the time. Not a lot, but you kept in touch pretty good, you know.
Did you ever think Man, I'm glad I'm not where that brother is.
Oh, yeah, I was glad I wasn't in Italy where my brother was.
And you're talking about your oldest brother. What was his name?
His name was Francis. He was in the 3rd Infantry.
One of the big battles in Italy, the big beachhead at Anzio, he was involved in that. Did you know that he was going to be part of that battle?
No, I didn't know until, you know, I didn't know where he was at for sure. Nobody told you, you know, you couldn't find out. All you had was an APO number, you know. I didn't even realize he was where he was at until I got the word that he'd been killed.
Well, and I think our listeners would be interested in that story of how you found out. So you had been trading letters with him, and you could actually get a letter to him faster in Italy than you could to your folks back here in Utah. How was it that you found out that he had been killed?
Well, I got 2 letters back from him that I had sent with just deceased written on them. So I didn't know. I was hoping some mail clerk had goofed up or something, you know. But I didn't know. It was just 2 letters that I had sent to him that come back to me with just deceased written on them. And I didn't dare write home and say anything until I knew for sure, you know. It was kind of a tough 2 weeks.
I can't imagine what that feels like here. I mean, you're over there, and you know that even if you feel like you're in a safe place, that danger is always lurking, and then to find out your brother has been killed. Did it take you a while to get over that? How did you cope with that news?
Oh, I don't know. It just, it was sad for a while, you know, and I felt more sorry for my poor little mother, and that bothered me more than, you know, anything.
And I've talked to quite a few veterans who lost siblings in the war, and their perspective is always a little different than those who didn't. And so many of you always tell me, hey, quit calling me a hero. The heroes are the guys who didn't come home. Your brother didn't come home. But some people have said, I really didn't want to know too much about what happened, and others really wanted to find out as much information as they could. Did you ever gather more information about what happened to him and how he was killed?
Yeah, I had a good friend that was in the same outfit that went and got to visit with him a couple of days before he got killed. And he told me that the artillery was coming over like crazy, you know. He says that was no place to be. But that's the only thing I've heard about it was what his name was Kent Snyder. He told me about it, you know.
You said about Pearl Harbor Day that it made you angry, and you talked about the way other people reacted to it. When you're in the European theater and you find out that the same enemy you're working against has killed your brother, did that make you angry? Did that add something to your resolve or determination?
Oh, yeah, it made me angry, you know. It's just, let's get this over with. Let's kick some rear. Let's get it over with.
And your role in that was not a small one. I mean, maybe this is something that you were suited for and you'd been doing your whole life, working on engines and all this, but I mean, did you ever grasp, I mean, how big a role you played and how what kind of impact you had? I mean, every engine that you're working on really is a 10-man crew's life in your hands if it's a B-17. Did you feel that responsibility or that importance?
Oh, no, you wanted to make sure they were right, you know. You worried about, you know, I hope this is everything is okay, you know. Hope it all works out.
Since you were over there from 43 through the end of the war in Europe, so you're there in England when the Normandy invasion takes place. You're there when the Battle of the Bulge happens and really every major development of that war. Is that something that you guys would react to there in England? I mean, when you got news of those kinds of things, was that a big deal? Do you remember how that news came in or what it meant to y'all?
Yeah, I can remember Battle of the Bulge. The guys at our base, the ones that they didn't figure were essential, they were instant infantry. We lost quite a few guys out of the base that they was from the Air Corps to the infantry immediately.
Because so many guys were killed and wounded, they needed those bodies, and yeah. That could have happened to you.
It sure could have. I lucked out all the way around. I'll be the first to admit it.
Well, do you think it was luck, or was somebody looking out for you? Was somebody pulling some strings for you?
Well, I don't think anybody was pulling any strings, but maybe it was just luck.
VE Day. What do you remember about that? How was that received at your base there in England?
Oh, gosh, everybody shooting guns in the air and hollering and raising cane. Just a lot of celebration.
But you still didn't get yourself in any trouble?
No, I didn't get in any trouble.
Once that happened, were you thinking, hey, I might get to go back home to Utah?
Well, yeah, we didn't know, but I have to tell you a little story. We didn't know whether we were going to have to go to the Pacific or what, but it ended up we come back to the States, and my outfit disbanded in Tampa, Florida. I went down there, and we were unpacking all the equipment, and we had this one big box that was stamped office equipment, and we opened it up. It was a moonshine still. The guys, they didn't know whether they were going to go to the Pacific or what, so they wanted to make sure they had something where they could make whiskey, you know. That captain, he went berserk. What in the hell are we going to do with this?
I'm sure some guys had some ideas.
Yeah. Well, that was the whole idea. If they thought it was going to go to the Pacific, they were going to be ready.
I imagine that was quite a relief to find out you didn't have to go to the Pacific.
Yeah, it was. I was glad to get home.
And what was that like? To see your mother again, because you know that she's lost one of her boys, and now you're coming home and to see your folks and your family. What was that like?
Well, it was great. In fact, when I got out of the service, I rode a bus from Tampa, Florida to Los Angeles, because my one brother was getting out of the Navy in Shoemaker, California, and I waited there 3 or 4 days for him to get out. He never showed up, so my brother-in-law drove truck outfit here in Orem, and they were coming to Provo, so I bummed a ride home with them, and I left that morning, and my brother got in that afternoon. So it was a while after that before I got to see him. My other brother, he was living in Orem. He got home. He beat me home.
Was it difficult to get on with life after you got out of the service, or was that an easy transition for you?
It was a pretty easy transition for me. I ended up doing a lot of the same things, you know, but it wasn't much of a transition for me. I done fine with it.
How often, I mean, it's been 70 years since all this happened. How often in those early years after the war and maybe even on till today, have you found yourself thinking about your brother Francis?
Oh, yeah, I think about it all the time, you know. He and I probably didn't get along as good as we should have, you know, but he was more of a, he's the oldest brother, so he is more domineering, you know. Mm-hmm. And I kind of resented that, so we had our differences times, but I always felt bad about that. I think we hadn't had a better relationship than we did, you know. But
have you ever found yourself wondering what his life would have looked like? I mean, you know your life. You're still going strong here at 92 with all these kids and grandkids and even great-great-grandkids. Have you ever wondered what his life would have looked like?
Oh, yeah, you think about that. You know, he was married. He got married just before he went into service. You wonder how would he made out, you know, what he had done. When he went into service, he was working for Utah Power and Light. He had a good job, but he went on the first draft.
Well, again, I don't want to put words in your mouth or put thoughts in your head, but something tells me when you went to the National World War II Memorial, which you had to wait a long time for that puppy to be built, but you've been back there a couple times, even for a reunion with your base air depot. When you got to that memorial and you saw that wall of gold stars and realized that's 406,000 Americans who died in World War II, I'm guessing you might have thought about your brother a little bit there.
Yeah, I thought about him. In fact, I contributed $100 to have his name. I didn't know whether you're going to put him on the memorial or what, but they have a record of all those.
Yeah.
So I made sure that he got his name on that.
Yeah, if you go to the World War II Memorial, you can go to a kiosk and search the registry and find those names. And some veterans have shared that, you know, they go to the Vietnam Memorial and they see all the names on the wall, and sometimes they're disappointed that they don't see the names at the World War II Memorial of those who were killed. Does that bother you at all, or is it just too big of a task, you think?
Well, I was a little disappointed. I thought maybe they'd have the names on the memorial somewhere, but there's probably so many they probably couldn't have got them all on there.
406,000 names would take up a lot of space, but I still think it would be powerful to have them all listed somewhere in a permanent memorial. Not to take away from the gem of the National Mall, that gorgeous memorial we've been talking about, but just a new way to recognize all of those, like Francis de Saint-Jure, who paid the ultimate price. It's time to take another break, but remember, you can find photos relating to today's program at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. I also have some links where you can dig deeper into the Freckleton air disaster that Max witnessed. When we come back, we're going to learn about a special way that Max and his family have honored the legacy of his brother and other veterans in their hometown. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Paul Everett's RV Country has 8 locations in 5 western states, including Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, right off the I-5, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. Over 55 years of experience serving the needs of RVers across the country and proud supporters of Hometown Heroes. Find a location near you by visiting rvcountry.com. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive. And then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.